Ken, one of the things you talked about is that difficulty of not becoming co-opted and making the decision whether to engage with, so in your case, engaging with the big TV companies, or and in some way compromise your message, or disengage and then become disadvantaged in the sense of the potential broadcast to a larger public. How difficult is that decision? And you're very clear about it, but do you sympathise with those who have to struggle within those systems, or do you think that they are compromised by them?
No, I don't sympathise with them at all. You asked a few questions there. Wasn't one. I can't even, the middle one I remember. That's my answer. I haven't got time for people that compromise. But I think the thing about the audience is that Channel 4, if you show a film on Channel 4, you might get 20,000 people watching it, or 30 or something like that. No, not 20. Yeah, millions. Let's say a million, 2 million. There's 7 billion people on the planet, so that's our audience. That's the way we look at it. But I think the thing for us was that it was important that we stuck to what we believed in. And we were given a lot of opportunities to cut the film. The BBC came to a big film festival and they said, we'd like to show this film, but you need to cut it. So we said, we're not going to cut it, but we'll give you the film and you can cut out the bits you don't want to show and you show it on BBC. And we're not going to cut it on principle. Because for us, the silencing of the families, the silencing of their political struggle was the same issue. And if the families refuse to be silenced, why should we? We'd be traitors if we did that. And I think anybody that works with families and producers, well, any community of interest and produces a piece of work which doesn't reflect the central core of what that community is struggling for are traitors. So we said to BBC, if you want to cut the film, you can show it. And they said, no, we can't do that. And we said, why? They said, because you have to do it. You understand what they mean by that. They wanted compliance, and we weren't prepared to be compliant. So, but we've offered it to them to do what they like with it. It doesn't really matter if they cut the film. In reality, the message comes through. People who haven't even seen the film, they'll read the report, and people will get the message that police officers are committing murder and the state is condoning it, and the people. So that message gets through.
Let's get a question. One thing I thought about in terms of this evening is maybe I'll ask this to Fergal and Andy, is, you know, we often think of culture as a means, as a medium, as a means of expression, of expressing, let's say, a particular feeling. But is there a case to be made as well that culture in many ways becomes, as Ken said, I suppose you can't separate society here and culture there, that the culture becomes part of the resilience that leads to political change, that it actually enables people, that it isn't as simple as seeing it as a medium?
Well, I think that's definitely true. If you look at the experience of the Asian news movements, I mean, I referenced today the way in which they were inspired, say, for example, like the poetry of Bobby Sands. But obviously, they were referencing their own culture, and they were using that, in a sense, to highlight all kinds of issues, you know, reading Fares on the Fares and his poetry after the Massacre of Sabra and Shatila, all of those kind of things. So it was very much integral to how they worked. They would bring their dhol and stuff like that, the big drums and stuff on marches, which, you know, created senses of belonging and identity, all of that kind of thing. But I just want to come back, actually, to the previous point that you were talking about in terms of co-option. One of the strongest narratives, in fact, in my book is about that whole process of funding and the way it shifts, you know, agendas. So from 1976 to 1980, the AYMs took no funding. They were very much grassroots organizations funded by the youth, you know, and therefore they took up the issues that they were able to address the questions of not just street racism, but the racism of the state in quite kind of direct ways. Now, particularly after 1981, of course, after the Scarman Report, etc., a lot of funding came in. And actually, that was the moment at which you saw the disintegration of the youth movements. So it actually destroyed that independent organizing. And say, for example, Bradford Asian Youth Movement got all involved in setting up a community center. They were so involved in that kind of infrastructure, cultural projects, etc., that the core reasons for why the organization was established, those kind of campaigns that they were involved with became completely sidelined until actually that work, you know, disappeared. And so, you know, there are a lot of questions. This is not to say that there aren't rules for working within the state, because apart from anything, some of the struggles were about resources. But you have to be careful about what the issues are that you're working towards, your central demands and concerns are, and within some of those things. If you are struggling against state racism and you then take the funding from the state, you are compromising what you can do. And in fact, in terms of the immigration campaigns, the ones in 1980, 1981, 82, many of those were successful. And the youth were very much driven by their belief in that they were struggling for justice. As the 80s wore on, and you started to see much more campaigning sort of groups within councils, what happened was that councils would put on minibuses to take youth to demonstrations. So you could go and apply to borrow the council's minibus. But because you were borrowing the council's minibus and it wasn't costing you anything, you just kind of went round and people say, oh yeah, we're taking a minibus. The work, if you like, the work of mobilization on the ground didn't take place. So you would end up having things like minibuses and coaches going from Manchester to Birmingham with hardly anybody on them. Whereas before, because the youth were paying for them, they were sort of really involved in this whole kind of process, they would fill them. So, you know, it actually created a process whereby organization disintegrated. And that's something that's, you know, we all have to kind of be aware of. And it privileged certain campaigns, certain issues against others.
No, I think that if you look at it in the round, no two situations are the same. But if you take the example of what happened with the Irish language movement in the north here, I remember when I interviewed Seamus McShane, who you mentioned earlier on, was the founder of this place, one of the founding fathers of the community revival, who was shot and survived. He said to me, in the 60s, there was no state. His term was near abundance, that there was no state. The state put you in jail. So you couldn't even countenance the dealing with the state for fear of ending up incarcerated. So you did it yourself by necessity. So when the first school was founded in 1871, it existed for 14 years without state funding. And his sole role for 14 years was to fundraise for 8 teachers. Now those teachers got a similar wage, a bit less than what, but now these were proper teachers, these were qualified teachers, they were parent teachers. And his role was the fundraise for them. So he never filled in a funding application, never wanted to fill in a funding application, but he understood when a younger generation was coming along and saying, but we deserve status as a school, we are entitled to the resources of the state, so we can go on being a parish school forever, but eventually we want a second school and a third school and a fourth school. It's not sustainable. So at some stage we'll have to negotiate with the state. When this place here was founded, they wrote, James McShane and Garage O'Carroll wrote, as I said, on the back of a cafe bill, what would go on here, and they listed it down. The projects were already in conception, but they brought them here. They never thought about funding. They never said, okay, we want to start something, we'll get funding. They'll start it, and you can think about funding under the line. Now, within 4 or 5 years, they eventually got people employed through unemployment aid schemes to do some of the work, and they eventually applied to groups like the Art Council, Arm's Length, probably like the Arts Council, or Forest and Gilligan, and got some modicum of funding to be able to do the work that they were doing. But the whole time it was a perennial struggle and a perennial negotiation. And in the meantime, the Northern State, the British government here, decided to make the Irish language a battleground. So in the early 1980s, in the aftermath of the hunger strike, the policy that they had was this idea of depoliticisation. And what they were saying, come back to the question that you asked, is culture is okay if it's in this box, if it's in the empire's box. If it tries to deviate out of it, then it's controversial, it is divisive, and it doesn't deserve the funding that it actually gets. So the Cultural Traditions Group, which was founded in the early 1980s, would have actually culminated in the foundation of the UltTAC Trust, which was a body that promoted the Irish language in a cross-community capacity. No one had a problem with that, but the reality was the first time the British state funded Irish language activism in the north, it had to be cross-community. What that immediately did was sectarianise the Irish language activism, demonise those people who were promoting the Irish language in Republican communities, and exclude what they were doing. That was a long battle, and it wasn't until the 1980s that that work was advanced to agonised. But the people who were doing that work would argue that they were entitled to it. They argued that they were entitled to those resources. But the perennial battle that brings us to the present day is that what happens when you become overtly dependent on it? What happens when you lose that vision? What happens in the case of the North here in a post-conflict context where the situation has changed? If we look at Fela football, for example, when that was founded in the late 1980s, it was founded within the context of overt military oppression. When this area was occupied militarily, people were being shot and killed on a daily basis. So people were doing it as an outward expression of resistance. When that changes and Fela and football all of a sudden applies to and is entitled to state funding for being an excellent community festival, the dynamic changes. So how does you negotiate at the terrain and stay true to your principles? It's not something that's hard and fast. It's something that's always in flux, and something that we always have to be conscious of. But I know in terms of the Irish language movement, this year reclaiming of a vision of cooperative type projects is coming to the fore, because people are realising they don't always need to wait on the state. Not everything can be grant funded, and on top of it, places like the Cultalan here has just had 20% of its funding cut. So groups are having their funding cut, and in a way, in a perverse way, that's making them, some of the groups, revisit this whole idea of doing stuff in a self-sufficient way.
Further questions or comments? Yes, just one.
Yeah, culture. I'm a person who's actually a cultural, not cultural, preserver of cultural law across people. Basically, people in the world, they all love every child on the planet. Social contract, but in many instances, it's the actual culture, the inherited culture of those countries that are doing most damage. Excuse me, I'm thinking of culture that I live in this group, I lived in London for 43 years. I live with every culture, you know, in every place, and certainly what I actually saw was that some, for instance, some of my friends, like the way they were treated women and the way their fathers treated women. You know, we have culture in sub-Saharan Africa. My dear and I knew girls who, you know, so really, culture by itself, an awful lot of it needs to be modernized. And culture and the preservation of it is sometimes the problem.
So, another question?
Very quickly, guys, because I'm running for the time, so if you want to
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just come back to this question of culture, because I think when we think about culture, we have to understand that culture is not static. And if we're talking about culture within a society, there are also many different and diverse ways in which people live, even within one society. I think also that we have to think about periods that we live in and the way in which sometimes certain kinds of reactionary elements of a culture are sometimes privileged at particular moments. So, for example, we look at Afghanistan. Now, everyone will go on about the fact, you know, Afghan women are oppressed and blah, 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 blah. But if we think about the fact that actually, if you go back into the 70s, you know, Afghanistan was actually, you know, had quite a progressive society. Women were heavily integrated within all kind of public culture, you know, as well as other forms of culture. They had the vote before. Women in Afghanistan had the vote before many women in European countries. So, you know, this notion that culture in certain places is reactionary is something I think that we have to be careful of, because then what we're doing is actually looking at culture as something that's static. Culture is not something that existed and was created hundreds of years ago that we then just continue. It's transforming all the time. And so, for example, I'll just give you one example, and this is relating to people that were involved in the Asian Youth Movement. Mukhtar, who I referred to, who was a fine artist, you know, he then went on to been working at the Drum in Birmingham, and recently what he did, he wanted to bring together the music of two different places that were, which two different both dub and Qawwali and Sufi music. He wanted to bring them together because he found both of those musics highly spiritual, and then create something new, to create a new and a hybrid culture. And actually, okay, so if we look at sort of dub and Sufi, we can say, oh yeah, here's a hybridity taking place, and you know, we're very conscious of it. But actually, that happens in culture all the time in every society. And what we want to do and search out for is the progressive culture in every society. And you know, and it exists. We should never see, because you know, the thing is that what you're falling into is something that can actually end up having like a kind of a racist sort of tinge to it, in terms of saying sub-Saharan African cultures have this thing that's backward. There is backwardness in every culture, in British culture, in Irish culture, in Indian culture, in Pakistani culture, everywhere. And there's also progressive elements to those cultures. Yeah, they do all the time.
There's some places in the world where, because every culture has its rulers and shapers, some of those that have been hard actually don't want to change, and you're actually in a situation.
But that is the case in Britain, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Cameron.
Guys,
you know,
I'm going to have to draw to a close, because I'm aware we have to get somewhere off there. But can we thank our speakers? Thank you all for coming. It's a very interesting.